Okay, we're continuing now with chapter 4, which you have in front of you. All right? And again, we'll be looking at these strange musings of Kohelet as he starts with the following notion. V'shavti ani ve'ereh et kol ha'shukim asher nasim tachad ha'shamesh. He says, I have turned about, is how they translate it, but I have returned, which again emphasized what we said before, the view of the Ralbag and others, that Kohelet is not just kind of a straight discussion, but he goes back and forth in his considerations of what is taking place in this world. And he says, I've returned and I've seen all of those who are oppressed, all that takes place under the sun. And behold, the tears of those who are oppressed is great. They have no one to comfort them. And forcefully do others oppress them. And again, they have no comfort. And because of this, he says, V'shabeach ani et ha'metim, I have praised those who are dead. Those shekavar metu, those who have already died. Min ha'chayim, greater than those who are living, asher hem ha'chayim adena, those who are still alive. V'tov mishnehem et asher aden lo haya, better than both of these, those who are living and those who are dead, are those who were never born. Asher lo ra'at amasa ara, who did not see these terrible things, asher nasa tachat ha'shamesh, which take place and which have taken place under the sun. Again, we have Kohelet, where if you would choose to put this in the biblical canon, you'd probably say, no way. This does not sound anything like Judaism. It is completely the opposite, where we praise life, how wonderful life is. Yes, there are problems and so on. But Kohelet, back to the idea again, that, again, the way he says it, he hasn't said it before in this way, I praise those who are dead, you know, better off to be dead than to be alive. Oh no, better to never have been born at all. I want to comment on some of these issues, not from Torah text per se, but from other things I'm going to bring in. I don't know if I read you once before in this class. Did I read you Edna St. Vincent Millay's Renaissance? Because I just want to point out something here that's very significant, because what she says in this poem is exactly what is being said here. This notion that there's so much suffering, so many people are oppressed, and there's nothing to do about it. And what can you do when people are suffering all over the place? There's no one to comfort them, no one to help them. Better off to be dead. Better off to be dead than have to experience this. So in Edna St. Vincent Millay's Renaissance, which I thank Rabbi Ephraim Buchwald for introducing me to many, many years ago, I'm just going to give you part of this, the part which is relevant to what we're reading here. She says, all I saw from where I stood were three long mountains and a wood. Over these things I could not see. These were the things that bounded me, and I could touch them with my hand, almost, I thought, from where I stand. And all at once, things seemed so small, my breath came short and scarce at all. But sure, the sky is big, I said, miles and miles above my head. So here upon my back I'll lie and look my fill into the sky. And so I looked, and after all, the sky was not so very tall. The sky, said, must somewhere stop. And sure enough, I see the top. The sky, I thought, is not so grand. I most could touch it with my hand. And reaching up in my hand to try, I screamed to feel it touch the sky. I screamed, and lo, infinity came down and settled over me. So part one, she has suddenly become infinite. She's become identified with eternity somehow in this vision she had in this poem. I saw and heard and knew at last the how and why of all things past. For my omniscience, I'm skipping around, paid I toll in infinite remorse of soul. All sin was of my sinning, all atoning mine, and mine the gall of all regret. Mine was the weight of every brooded wrong and hate that stood behind each envious thrust. Mine every greed, mine every lust, and all the while for every grief, each suffering, I craved relief with individual desire. Craved all in vain, and felt fierce fire. About 1,000 people crawl, perished with each, when mourned for all. A man was starving in Capri. He moved his eyes and looked at me. I felt his gaze, I heard his moan, and knew his hunger as my own. I saw a sea, a great fog bank between two ships that struck and sank. A thousand screams the heavens smote, and every scream tore through my throat. No hurt I did not feel, no death that was not mine, mine each last breath. That crying met an answering cry from the compassion that was I. All suffering mine, and mine its rod, mine pity like the pity of God. Ah, an awful weight, infinity, pressed down upon the finite me. My anguished spirit, like a bird, beating against my lips I heard. Yet lay the weight so close about, there was no room for it without. And so beneath the weight lay I, and suffered death, but could not die. So this is the terrible experience, she says, of understanding the suffering that others have to feel, that Qohelet is experiencing in his discussion as well. Long had I lain thus, craving death, when quietly the earth beneath gave way, and inch by inch so great, at last had grown the crushing weight. Into the earth I sank till I, full 6 feet underground did lie, and sank no more, there is no weight, can follow here, however great. So she prays to die because of all the suffering in the world, and she dies. She feels herself in the grave underneath. And going on, deep in the earth I rested now, cool is its hand upon the brow, and soft its breast beneath the head of one who is so gladly dead. And all at once, and over all, the pitying rain began to fall. I lay and heard each pittering hoof upon my lowly thatched roof, and seemed to love the sound far more than I had ever done before. For rain it hath a friendly sound to one who's 6 feet underground, and scarce the friendly voice or face. A grave is such a quiet place. She then says as follows. O God, I cried, give me new birth and put me back upon the earth. Upset each cloud's gigantic gourd and let the heavy rain down poured. Is one big torrent set me in one big torrent set me free, washing my grave away from me. I know not how these things can be. I only know there came to me a fragrance such as never clings to aught save happy living things. And she goes on to say how she was given life anew again. I know not how such things can be. I breathed my soul back into me. Ah, up then from the ground sprang I, and hailed the earth with such a cry as is not heard save from a man who had been dead and lives again. Now, I used this on Yom Kippur once. The idea was given to me by Rabbi Effie Buchwald, but I'm using it for Qohelet. Again, this is exactly her feeling being expressed here. You see all the suffering in the world, somebody says, I just can't take it anymore. Not your own suffering, necessarily. You're seeing the suffering of others. Rather just be dead. And it seems like Qohelet is saying this. You see, not. All the suffering, I praise those who are dead already. Better you should be dead than alive. No, better you should never have been born. This is Qohelet exactly in Edna St. Vincent Millay. Now, furthermore, however, I also want to point out one of my favorite movies, It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart. Exactly this situation. The main point being expressed here by Qohelet, again, the same idea, is that at first he considers it's better to be dead. Then, no, it's better, I guess, not to have ever been born at all. And Jimmy Stewart, in a terrible situation, and other people are going to suffer because of him, decides, instead of wanting to be dead, he wishes he would never have been born. And then the whole plot of this beautiful movie is to show, if you would not have been born, this would have happened. Your uncle Billy, okay, who now has a nice job and is living a normal life, would have been put into an insane asylum because you weren't there to help him. And your brother, who saved all these people in World War II from this terrible crash of two planes, all those people died because you didn't save your brother when you were a little boy. No one was there to save him when he fell into the ice, and he would have drowned except you saved him. And this Mr. Gower, who was a druggist, because he was upset because his own son died, and he poisoned someone else, and therefore was sent to prison, you stopped him from poisoning this person when you saw, when you were filling out the instructions, you stopped him and told him he made a mistake. You weren't there, so you didn't stop him. And people in town who were going to be nice, normal people and live normal lives couldn't do so because instead of you renting homes to them, building homes for them at a normal price, they had to give in to Mr. Potter, who built all of these homes at an extravagant price, and they lost all their money, and then they had to go gamble, and then the town became a town of ill repute. It became Las Vegas, if you will, and then all these shows were going on of nude women and everything, and the whole town came down because you, George, weren't there to lead people to live just a normal, regular life. And the message is, all of us are significant. We may not think of it sometimes as this, but we've had influence upon others. We've saved people. We've helped people. We've led people in the right direction. Even though sometimes life doesn't feel that way, we've all done that. So George, thinking it's better not to have ever been alive, is taught a lesson that that's not the case, that life is far better than death or not living at all. But Kohelet is experiencing this and considering it, that perhaps this is the case. Now again, the Ralbag and others, we've learned already, the Ibn Ezra, have suggested that he's just putting this forth as the feelings that many people have, not necessarily the feeling that you should have. And that, again, that this is just a consideration that he's later going to reject.
No, but isn't that the case in the Talmud, that Hillel and Shammai have a disagreement as to whether or not it would have been
yes. That's correct. The Gemara in Eivruvin says that Yud Gimel, in fact, that Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai have debate. Was it better for man to have been born or not to have been born? And the decision was
not to have been born.
Not to have been born. Of all things, not to have been born. But now that he's been born, now that he's been created, let him look into his deeds. Let him examine his deeds carefully. They debated for 2 years, 2.5 years. Then they concluded, you're right, Beit Shammai. Should not have been born. Now he's been born, let him investigate his deeds.
Perhaps the reason is because the soul up in heaven is so happy to be with God, and to have to be forced into coming into this world with all its trials and difficulties, it is a hardship for the soul. And so maybe that's the Kabbalistic or mystical reason as to why Beit Shammai felt that better than the soul not have to be born, because it's just so much happier to be up in heaven with the Almighty. But how does that play into Kohelet, and how do we reconcile?
Okay, so you're, by the way, just interesting, you're presuming that the soul was created, you know, irrelevant of the body. The soul already existed. So there's the question I was putting into the body. I always understood it to mean like they're created at the same time. No, I may be wrong. I'm sure some understand like I do, and therefore the whole question is on the soul as well. But you're saying the question was on putting the soul in the body. Really, that was the question. But the question is, man being created was the question of the human being. Why did God create the human being in the first place? That's why I thought it had nothing to do with the soul separate. It would be the same question, why did God create the soul of man? Why did God create man in general? That's what I thought. Now, how it plays into Kohelet, it's interesting. It's kind of an unusual view. I saw Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman discuss the following. He asked the question, how could it be that if Kohelet says, and he confirms what the Gemara you quoted, it's better that man should not have been born. But we saw such a crazy thing, the Gemara says, right? So Kohelet says it's better that man should not have been created. If that's the case, Rav Elchanan Wasserman says, so how could Beit Hillel have said, no, it's better he should have been created? What do you mean you're disagreeing with the Bible? The Kohelet says, it's better he should not have been born, like Beit Shammai. And you, Beit Hillel, says he's better he should have been born. You're disagreeing with the Bible. What are you doing, Beit Hillel? So he answers, at least I give you an answer, he says, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, we know that the Gemara itself has a debate. If Kohelet, remember the first week, should be included in the biblical canon or not. The Mishnah has the debate. In Masechet Yadayim, should we include Kohelet in the biblical canon? Because there's so many controversial things. So he wants to suggest that Beit Hillel and Shammai, when they were having their debate, it was still not resolved that the book of Kohelet should be included in the biblical canon. And that's why Beit Hillel could disagree with Kohelet, because at that point Kohelet was not yet part of the Bible. So therefore, he could argue what he wanted to argue, and they could have that discussion. In fact, maybe I'm just going further. He doesn't say it, but maybe after 2.5 years it was included, and that's why Beit Hillel agreed. Okay, they gave in. All right, you're right. You see that the Kohelet, we've accepted Kohelet, and it says it's better that it wasn't, that man wasn't created, and therefore, all right, I guess you were right, Beit Shammai. But now let's all agree that once we've been created, we have to examine our deeds. You have, however, if Shul made an excellent point here, and that is that I was presenting the view of Kohelet as being one which ultimately he would reject as just being one of his musings wherein you are pointing out that it seems from the Gemara itself, from the discussion of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, that the conclusion is in fact in agreement with Kohelet, that it would have been better for man never to have been created. The only thing I can say, and I've tried to deal with this Gemara in general from such a perspective, is that perhaps maybe we can say it means as follows, that from the perspective of the human being, so of course it is better that man should have been created. A human being wants to live, a human being wants to be a part of this world and not just to exist in nothingness for eternity. However, as it were, from the perspective of the Ribbono Shel Olam, would it have been better if man would not have been created with the way that man has messed up the world and led it to such chaos? Yes, from the way and the perspective of the Ribbono Shel Olam, there we can all agree that it would have been better if man would not have been created, but nonetheless, because he has chosen to create us, then let us thereby follow the rules that he has given us in order to try as best we can, despite our imperfections, to make it worthwhile that we were put on this earth. On the other hand, just to indicate the complexity of this subject, one could argue just the opposite. One could claim that that machlokas has to do from the perspective of man, from the perspective of the Ribbono Shel Olam. So what's the question? Is it better that man should have been created or not? Of course it's better that man should have been created from the view of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Ribbono Shel Olam created man. He did so purposely. He did so saying that it was very good on the sixth day. So certainly from his perspective, and only from his perspective, I would say, because he has the grand view of things, the view of eternity, so he can say that yes, it was worthwhile to create the human being. However, from our limited perspective, wherein we see all of the terrible corruption that humanity has brought unto God's world, so from our perspective, we could claim that it's a question if it was really fitting for man to be created or not. So again, those are the two sides that show how difficult this question is, but I think we'd have to use that in order to still affirm that we would all agree that it is better for man to have been created. Now that he's been created, let him look at his deeds. The question was only coming from a particular perspective in that machlokas from Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Maybe that's some way of dealing with Gemara. But still, at this point, it seems to many in even today's world something that is very attractive. And what I'd like to go on and discuss now is therefore the consideration that he's put forth. It's better to be dead than alive, the notion of suicide in Jewish tradition. And I think we will see, as I'll point it out to you, that it's not so clear as we normally think of it in terms of what the Jewish attitude towards suicide is. At first, it seems to be clear. There's a pasuk in Genesis in Bereshit. Already we're told in Bereshit Tet Hey the following statement. Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam bidamo yishafech. That if you take the blood, you shed the blood of another person. But there's an extra word, ba'adam. Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam. If you shed the blood of another person, in the person. What does it mean, in the person? In the person. What does that mean? So Chazal, the rabbis understand that to mean, if you shed the blood of a person, even in the person himself, you shed the blood of the person, it's an inside job. You shed your own blood. You shed the person, even of the person himself. That's the extra ba'adam. Even that is considered to be an act of murder, and one will suffer the death penalty for sure, but not just in this world by taking his own life, but in the next world as well. You have no place in the world to come if you take your own life. It's seen as the most heinous of crimes possible. Why is that so? Because it's a frontal attack upon God. God is the author of life and death, not you. That is the one thing God has over everyone. He is the author of life and death. He created life. Melech may mitu mechayeh. God is the one who kills and gives life. It's not you. No one has that right. But you usurping this role of God and saying that I am the author of life and death, So that is seen, therefore, as the worst possible crime that one can commit. And as a result, the halacha is, as the Rambam says, and brought down in all halachic works, that one who commits suicide receives no honors after he has taken his life. He receives no honors. So consequently, that means he would get no eulogy. No eulogies for a suicide. And he would not get some, say, the rites of Shiva. Shiva, you know, you observe for a person because he was a worthy person, he was a significant person, so you mourn for him for 7 days. This person, don't mourn for him.
Is that practice?
Hold on. So this is what the halacha says, no mourning for such a person, right? Some say no Kaddish for such a person. Don't say Kaddish for him. He doesn't deserve a Kaddish. The person of Kaddish, purpose to save a person from Gehenim, from being judged harshly for 12 months and going to hell. You know what? That person should go to hell, if you will. He committed suicide. Don't say Kaddish for him. Do nothing in his honor. This is brought down in all the halachic works that this is in fact the case. Now you ask, is that practiced? Do you know someone who committed suicide and it wasn't? Or you just
I've never heard of someone who committed suicide.
Okay. So it so happens that it is not practiced. And why not? This is halacha. And it's certainly a strong statement. You commit suicide, you should know. This is the most terrible thing you can do. No one's going to honor you as a result. It's a very strong statement. It seems like it significantly was put in this language, you know, in this format, so that a person should not commit suicide. And yet it is not generally practiced. And the reason is because the Gemara says, Hama'abed atzmo lada'at. Someone who willfully takes his own life, who is aware of what he's doing, if you will, I have sound mind and body, I'm going to take my own life. Someone does that, all this applies. But if someone was distraught, someone was upset, someone had just lost his job, someone had just lost a relative, someone had just undergone a painful divorce, whatever the case is that you can think of. So there, rabbinic authorities generally say that we presume in that case that the person did not willfully do it. They didn't really know what they were doing. They were so upset. They couldn't think properly. And therefore, these things are, in fact, applied. All these honors are given in this situation. Even to the degree today, I should point out one other thing. In the cemetery, you know, we bury people in cemeteries in an interesting way. We don't all do it in our kind of American cemeteries. But for example, in Israel, the cemeteries have separate cemeteries or places for those who kept Shabbos and those who didn't. Yeah? There are cemeteries that are Shomer Shabbos cemeteries. Because being Shomer Shabbos is a different level than those who are not. And it says in the Gemara, you don't bury those who are wicked, if you will, next to those who are righteous. So therefore you have the righteous and the wicked not buried next to each other. That's the idea, by the way, of having Jewish cemeteries, some say, and non-Jewish cemeteries. Where again, there are people who are not Jewish who are righteous, of course, but the idea being that people who observe one level of mitzvot, right, 613 mitzvot, should be separated from those who did not observe 613 mitzvot. Suicides were always placed separately from other people. They were put like the separate part of the cemetery, farther away from everyone else. They're not buried with everyone else, in order to indicate, to underscore once again, that they were not worthy to be buried with these righteous people. Put them on the side.
So obviously all men made decisions.
These
but
things?
God made us all in his image, all of us, suicide or not.
Right.
So therefore it had to be a man-made decision to separate people who committed suicide from others. God loves all people.
Well, I don't know what you mean. God loves, he does love all people, that's true, but he also punishes people, you know, even though he loves them, if they did not follow what he said to do. I mean, throughout the Bible we have punishment for people. He destroys worlds. I mean, destroys the generation of Noah and so on, because I love you, but sorry, you're violating.
But it's very arbitrary to say, like, okay, you can have someone who kept Shabbat but cheated, then you have a Madoff who kept Shabbat, and then you have people that didn't. But
yeah, he didn't, by the way. Just to make that clear.
Okay,
no, because by the way, it said in the paper this week, they were talking about where he liked to eat, and some of his famous delicacies were pork, were ribs, and other things like that. So although he was involved in Yeshiva University and others, it's clear that he was not at all Orthodox.
I'm just making a point.
Yes.
Then you could have somebody who didn't keep Shabbat, but like built an orphanage and cared for the sick and the poor, so it's kind of an arbitrary.
Yes, so that is true. That is true in the sense that only God is the, we said Baruch Dayan Amen, only God is the true judge. And knowing what a person, you kept Shabbos, but you were a bum, you kept Shabbos, but you were a thief, you kept Shabbos. So certainly there too, if we knew that were the case, I would say we wouldn't bury a Shomer Shabbos in that cemetery. He was a Shomer Shabbos, but he was a mass murderer. No, he does not get buried there. He was a Shomer Shabbos, he was the greatest thief in history. No, he does not get buried there. They just gave that as kind of a measuring stick. Because Shmira Shabbos is one of the Ten Commandments, keeping Shabbos. One cannot deny that it is a fundamental of the Jewish faith, whether there are those of us here who keep it or not, that is seen as a fundamental of Jewish life. So, you know, there's a famous story told by a person who kept Shabbos, and he said to his father, he said, "Well, Dad, what do you think? You see, you spent Shabbos with me. Aren't you proud of me? I'm a real Shomer Shabbos. I'm a real Shomer Shabbos. What do you say, huh?" And he said, "It's very nice, son. You're a real Shomer Shabbos. But what's equally important is, oh, are you a Shomer Vach? Do you keep the week like you keep Shabbos? And if you keep the week like you keep Shabbos with such determination and such commitment to details and so on about how you treat other people every day of your life, so then yes, then you're a real Shomer Shabbos. But if you're a Shomer Shabbos who is not careful the rest of the week, then you are not on the level which would make me proud." Okay? But what can I say? Jewish tradition certainly indicates that Shabbos is, you know, a statement, a strong statement about one's commitment to Jewish tradition. Just so much is this the case. Again, I'm not saying this. And what you said, it's not really arbitrary because it's said by the oral tradition. We believe the oral tradition came from Har Sinai just like the written tradition. But it says, for example, that a person who does not keep Shabbos has a status of an akum, has a status of an idolater. Now, how could that be? How could that be? That's crazy. What do you mean it's a status of an idolater? How could that be? Because it says, if you keep Shabbos, so you're saying God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh. And I attest to that because I rest on the seventh. If you don't rest on the seventh day, so according to the Gemara, so you're not seeing God as the creator of the world, as it were. And therefore, so if God's not free will, so you're going somewhere else. You're going away from God, so you're akin to an idolater. So the Gemara says someone who doesn't keep Shabbos has this status. Now, some say it only applies to people who are Mechal Shabbos Befarhesia, people who violate Shabbos publicly. Now, what does publicly mean? Some say it means, in other words, some might say this explanation. In his own home, he violates Shabbos. But when he goes out, he doesn't. So, if you do that, you're not in this realm. Others go even farther. They say that you're not considered to be violating publicly violating Shabbos unless you would do it mamish in front of someone like a rabbi. In other words, if you would go up to a rabbi and say, "Light me up my cigarette, please." And you really have no embarrassment whatsoever. You would just go right up to him and say, "Rabbi, watch me. I'm going to turn on the light. It's Shabbos. I don't care. I'm going to turn on the light." Then that is called like a wrongly, brazenly saying, "You know, I'm just going to violate Shabbos to your face." If you're not like that, so some say, so that's not the person we're talking about. We're talking for a person who, you know, would not go to that degree. We're not talking about that type of person. But again, these are seen as not arbitrary. The oral tradition which says someone who commits suicide receives this punishment is viewed in this way by God. Again, this is not arbitrary. It's seen as coming part of the oral tradition. Although, don't forget, as we've said now, even the oral tradition says that for someone who is not of sound mind and body, we're not necessarily talking about that type of person. In fact, the Aruch HaShulchan and others say that even if it's to a degree where we found a suicide note, "I am going to commit suicide, if life's not worth going on," and so on. Okay? And then let's say we found the person dead and it was determined that he died 2 days after he wrote that note. So we would say, you know what, then he may have changed his mind. How do we know it's really a suicide? Maybe someone still hung him. How do we know? We do everything possible to go out of our way to save a person from just having this status of someone who committed suicide. All right, and yet, just in theory, you understand from this that it is seen as this terrible, terrible crime of one thinking that he has possession over his own life when it's only God who has such ability to govern life and death.
But the book is something that any lawyer can apply a temporary insanity rule. So, you know, like they weren't in their right mind when they can spring in from the toilet.
You're right. Although, you know, we use it by suicide. I don't know if we use it by other things, but it's a good point, though. We do use it by suicide. We do tend to separate and send the idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, the only one, I guess, who would be, according to this, who could be seen as committing suicide knowingly was Socrates. Socrates committed suicide because he corrupted the young with his ideas. Right, so they said they had him as prisoner, and they said they would let him go, but he can't teach. He can't teach. He said, "What do you mean I can't teach?" And so I'm a teacher; it's my whole life. So he decided he was going to commit suicide, and that's what he did. And he reasoned all out and discussed it, and gave a whole essay on it. So it wasn't like I was distraught and I didn't know what to do. And he reasoned it out, and this is why I'm choosing to do this. And that would have been no, you have no right to commit suicide. You can't do that. That's wrong. But if it's all these other things where we found him, yesterday this just happened, he had found out this happened to his family, he found out he had this disease, he found out we generally work around it to help save, to help save the person. Now, however, there were people in Tanakh who committed suicide. Great people. Anyone know of any of them? Anyone in the Bible who committed suicide? One was Shaul HaMelech, according to some readings. There are different views. Some say he was killed by someone else. Some say he took his own life. Okay, in the Bible itself, there's a debate about it, it seems. King Saul, it seems, committed suicide. Anyone else? You all know someone who committed suicide. Samson, Shimshon, right? Committed suicide. He says, "Let me die together with the Philistines. Give me my strength this one last time." He commits suicide. In fact, that's the only case one could refer to, perhaps, of a suicide bombing in Jewish history. You know, with this most detestable of acts in our time, suicide bombings. You know, it's terrible. Did you read the paper today in Iraq? They have all these people that are trying to have run for elections, have a democracy and everything, and these suicide bombers keep killing him. Today in the paper that another guy, yet another candidate, who was supposed to run, killed by a suicide bomber. So they knock off all the candidates. Good. Good luck with your democracy. Knock off all the candidates. It's terrible. So suicide bombing. Here's Shimshon, Samson, suicide bombing. Going to bring them all down and going to kill himself with it. What is the reason Shimshon was allowed to do this, to commit suicide? Why could King Saul, why was he allowed to commit suicide? So the reasons are given by different views, different authorities. Some say Shaul HaMelech, when he committed suicide, it was because he felt that otherwise he would be taken prisoner. It would be a chil Hashem. It would be a desecration that they would make the king of Israel, let's say, do ridiculous things, make him crawl on his knees, make him do silly things, make him commit all sorts of crimes, bow down to idols, whip him to do so, whatever it was. And this would be such a desecration. And in that situation where one thinks he can't resist and he would be led to desecrate God's name, in that case, suicide is indeed permitted, some want to say, rather than bring this terrible notion to God in the world. So some want to say that's why, let's say, the people of Masada, as you said, were allowed to commit suicide. Because they would have been taken and raped and then forced to worship idols and they couldn't resist. They would have had to give in to that. So they committed suicide in the sense of God's name would not be desecrated.
Aren't you supposed to commit suicide if someone's trying to convert you? like, don't you?
Well, you're not supposed to commit suicide. What you mean is you're supposed to die.
It's the martyr.
If they say you convert or I'm going to kill you, then you have to be killed. You cannot convert. But yet the idea is usually you're not supposed to commit suicide either. Then kill me.
They have to kill you.
They have to kill you. But here we see if you would think you would resist and, if they don't kill me now, if I don't kill myself now, I know I'm going to give in. I am going to bow down to their idol. If I don't commit suicide, then some say it's permitted in those situations. Shimshon, they say, Samson, it was Al-Pi HaDibur. It was a specific case that you can't learn from because he asked, let me die from the Philistines, give me my strength. You saw God gave him his strength, and then he let him die. So apparently it was a unique case where God allowed it in that specific, unique circumstance. Because God's the one who answered his prayer, his unique prayer. But in a normative case, you cannot learn from Shimshon that anyone could just go ahead and do this.
Couldn't you just become a Marano and pretend you converted?
Yes, so there's a whole debate on that. Can you pretend you converted or not? So most hold you cannot do that. That's a case where, again, you have to give up your life rather than do so, even if it's by pretend, because you're showing non-Jews, you know what, the most important thing is to believe in one God, but you're right, I'll save my life, I'll fake it. No, you can't do that. You have to show that I would not give in, even at the threat of death. However, if you did become a Marano, the Rambam says those people should not be seen in a negative light if they could not resist, this desire to save their lives. But still, it would be proper, if you could, to give up your life, the Rambam says, in those cases.
Therefore, choose life. That doesn't make sense.
Therefore, choose life is only in a situation. It says that God gives you, he says today, the blessing and the curse. The blessing is following the commandments. The curse is if you don't follow the commandments. Therefore, choose life, it says, and follow the commandments. But it says even in the commandments that if it's a situation of idolatry, adultery, or murder, committing those crimes, there you're not supposed to choose life. There you're supposed to choose death. And other various incidents as well. If there's a public decree against the Jewish people, you're supposed to choose death. Or if you're told, even in the case of a custom, violate this custom, and again, it's a public decree against the Jewish people, where they're going to try to make us do things on a public level, then you have to choose death over life. And thank God, we are not in our times part of that segment of the Jewish people that had to do that, although throughout Jewish history, Jews did have to do that on a regular basis. And we have it lucky that we don't have to. Now, there are cases in the Gemara that are difficult, it seems, that also discuss the committing of suicide. Let me read you a few cases. The first case I'm going to give you is Gemara Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud Chet. You don't have this. Daf Yud Chet Amud Aleph. This is the case, a famous case, Rav Hananya ben Tradyon was put to death in the following terrible way. They took wool and they soaked it in water, and then they put it around his whole body, and then they burned him to death. And it took a long, long time for him to burn because he was protected by the wool, so he's sitting there suffering. His students say to him, open your mouth and let the flames go into your mouth and kill you more quickly. And he says, no, only the one who gave me life can take it away. Seems clear, consistent with what we're saying. But then as he suffers more, he is told by the executioner, the executioner says, if I take off your wool so you'll die more quickly, will I then have a place in the world to come? The executioner says, will I have a place with you in the world to come? And Rav Hananya ben Tradyon says, yes, I promise you, you will then have a place in the world to come. So he takes off the wool, and Rav Hananya ben Tradyon dies more quickly. So first question is, well, what do you mean? How could he die more quickly? But he said that only God could do this to make me die more quickly and take my life more. How could then he give the executioner the right to do it? And then the executioner afterwards dives into the flames himself. And a voice comes out of heaven and says that this executioner, just like Rav Hananya ben Tradyon, has a place in the world to come. And then Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was heard to say at one point, ah, that's what it means, the famous statement, that some earn life in the world to come throughout their whole lifetime, you know, serving God, and some do it just in a moment. Here's this executioner. His whole life, he's a wicked, terrible person. But in one moment where he sees the truth and he does an act of kindness to someone else, he shouldn't suffer, and he dives into the flames himself, he is also granted a place in the world to come.
He committed suicide by doing that.
Yes, exactly. So the question is, how could he get a place in the world to come by violating the law? He's not allowed to commit suicide. A non-Jew also, by the way, is not allowed to commit suicide. It's one of the Noahide laws. We quoted it from Genesis. You're not allowed to commit suicide. So how could he get the world to come by committing suicide, which is a terrible law, a terrible crime? So this is difficult. You know, people try to answer it. It's a difficult Gemara. Some want to say this was his act of tshuva, that he was doing tshuva. He was repenting, you know, by diving into the flames and by letting another person, you know, by lessening his suffering, and that's why he was granted a place in the world to come, because of that. Now this is difficult. There's a famous story with Rav Moshe Feinstein. They're not allowed to turn over Jews to the non-Jewish authorities lest they kill that Jewish person who was turned over. Now some say this doesn't apply today in our time. Again, we don't understand. Throughout Jewish history, if you turned a Jew over to the non-Jewish authorities, they would kill him. You know, let's say the non-Jew said, we're looking for a Jew because he owes us money. Fine. So if a Jew owes money, okay, so maybe they have a right to collect. But the non-Jews would whip him and kill him if he didn't pay back. So in Jewish history, you were not allowed to turn over someone to the wicked non-Jewish authorities who would kill the Jew. The person who did this was known as a Moser. Someone who turned over Jews. He was hated by the Jewish community because in every community you'd find a guy who the non-Jewish government would say, you know what, so-and-so, come here. If you turn over the Jews to us who we're looking for, we'll give you the best house. We'll make sure your family lives a good life. We'll give you whatever you want, okay? You just be our friend and you turn over any Jew we're looking for. And there were Jews who would do this, okay? They would say, okay, you know, there are people who do anything for money, right? I'll do it. So, Rav Moshe Feinstein, in his town in Europe, or in Russia, so there was such a person called so-and-so the Moser, who everyone knew. He would turn over Jews to the authorities, and those Jews would be killed. Alright? So, when it came that this non-Jew was on his, this Jew, the Moser, was on his deathbed, so the Chevra Kedisha came to see him, the burial society. And he said to them, listen, I've been a sinner my whole life, I recognize it now. I want to repent. So I ask you to do me this favor so I can atone for my sins. When you bury me, he said to the burial society, I want you, instead of burying me as you do everyone else, in the coffin, right, on the back, I want you to bury me face down. I want to be on my front in the coffin. The Chevra Kedisha said, what are you talking about? No one would do that. That's terrible. No one would do that to anyone. To bury him face down instead of face up? We won't do it. And he begged them. He said, please, I've been a terrible person. I've turned in so many Jews. It's the only way if I, my whole life while I'm buried underground can be face down like that and suffer like that and such an indignity. Only then will I be forgiven. Please, please do it. So they finally said, fine, we'll do it. So then they had second thoughts. They do the right thing. They went to Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was the rabbi of the town. They told him the whole story. He said, you can't do it. They said, but we promised him. He said, I don't care. Jewish law is Jewish law. The halacha is you have to bury a person, no matter who he is, the right way. You can't bury him like that. No, you can't do it. So he said, but we promised that you can't do it. So fine. So they went and they did it the normal way. On the way to the burial, so some big like Russian, you know, authority, big cop, you know, stopped them and he said, stop the funeral. And they said, what do you mean, stop the funeral? They said, yes, do not bury him. Open up the casket. And they said, what do you mean? This is unheard of. Open up a casket in the midst of our funeral? We're not opening up the casket. They said, open up the casket and we'll kill you. They said, what do you mean, open up the casket? Why? We've never done this before. Open up the casket. Fine. They have no choice. They open up the casket. They take a look, you know, they take off his tachritim, like his shrouds. They look at him, everything's fine. He's buried normally, right? And they say, okay, fine. Continue with the burial. Continue with the burial. Afterwards, they came up to him and they said to this policeman, what is it? I don't understand. What were you looking for? I'll tell you what we were looking for. our friend, the Moser, who turned you guys in, whose burial that was, he told us that you Jews were so disgusting that you would even bury him upside down. Okay? And we couldn't believe you would do it, but he said, yeah, they're going to do it. And we promised him if they would do that, we would commit a pogrom like the world never seen. We would kill all you Jews. And we would reward his family even more if they would do this to you. All right? But we see that it's not true. You're not that bad. And they buried you, they buried him regularly. So therefore, we're going to let it go. Do you see this? What do you learn from this? First of all, how some people can hate Jews. Even a Jew can be so self-hating that he would even in his death, he would fake everything. Fake that he's doing this for atonement to be forgiven so that the whole Jewish community would be taken down. So that his family would still be treated nicely. But the other thing you learned at the point of the story of Moshe Feinstein was the halacha authority said the halacha is the halacha. I can't get into emotions. I can't get into sensitivity here. The halacha is the halacha. You have to bury him the right way. I'm sorry. So my question is, now bringing back this here, how could it be that because he wanted to repent, so he dove into the flames, this executioner, and therefore, oh, he was forgiven, he had a place in the world to come. The halacha is the halacha. Why should I say he can make up his own means to repent by committing suicide? Right? That's what you're asking. And it's difficult. Why should that serve as an appropriate means of atonement that he should get a place in the world to come? Some say it is true that this is the answer, but it's still very difficult to understand. Maybe we can say, again, another explanation. A person who killed so many people, obviously this executioner who killed innocent people through the Romans, obviously was someone who was chayav mita himself, who deserved to die. The Gemara sometimes says, someone who deserves to die has a deen, is already considered dead. Let's say if someone would go kill that executioner, some might have said, he was already considered dead, that guy. He had killed so many people. He had a status of being dead. So maybe to throw himself into the flames, he was already seen as dead, like he didn't do anything significant. He was already seen as dead. I don't know a good answer. I haven't found one. But anyway, this is a case though in the Gemara where you have this idea of suicide or hurrying to death, euthanasia, whatever, and somehow a good result came out of it, which makes it difficult. Let me give you two more cases where you have such situations. Reb Yehuda Hanasi, the author of the Mishnah. When he was in the midst of dying, everyone was praying for him. When they were praying for him, so it seemed like he was suffering terribly, he wasn't helping. All right? They were praying that he should live. And so his maid, it says, his maid saw this happening, and she said, you know what, they're praying he should live, but he's suffering even more. Apparently down below they want him to live, but up above they want him to die. It's like a tug of war, like they're pulling on him to stay down, they're pulling on him to come up. So this maid said, this is not the way it should be. So she took a vessel and she threw it against the wall, and there was this huge noise, and everyone stopped for a moment from the praying, and in that moment when they stopped, his soul was taken. Now how do you view this? Wait a minute. How could she do this, the maid? How could she do this? She made this, so she caused his death. She caused him to stop praying and he died. How could she do this? Very strange. Furthermore, one more case, then we'll discuss these two cases. There's another case that happened where a woman, she was very old. She wanted to die. So she goes to a rabbi and she says, you know, I've lived a long life. I want to die. I keep living and living. I want to die. So the rabbi said, well, how did you live so long? She said, because I went to shul every day. I went to davening every day. That's why I lived so long. So the rabbi said, okay, Nusa, don't go and you'll die. Imagine I told a person that came to me, said, I want to die, rabbi. I said, yes, I'll die. I want to die. What do I do? Well, do you do any good mitzvah? I give a lot of tzedakah. So stop giving tzedakah. That's your big merit and you'll die. What kind of crazy thing is that? And yet, it happens and she dies. So all I can tell you is that the Mefarshim point out, the commentaries point out, you see from this that if it's not an action you're taking, if it's prayer, if it's something indirect, in other words, yes, you can't commit suicide. You can't. You can't turn off a machine for someone. But let's say prayer. People are praying, you want to stop the prayer. It's not a direct act, you're killing the person. People are praying, you want to stop the prayer. It's divinely connected. In this case, she lives such a long life because she went to shul every day. Okay, that's not putting a knife into someone. So stop going. Then it's God's decision. He's the one who gave you this merit anyway. So in those cases, apparently you are allowed to ask for someone's death, to ask for your own death. And this is where I mean that this is not perhaps what we would have expected from Jewish tradition that we saw earlier, with the such and such emphasis on the terrible nature of suicide. For Moshe Feinstein even holds, he Paskins and the Ran before him, one of the Rishonim, that if a person wants to pray for the death of someone or his own death because he's suffering greatly or someone else is suffering greatly, you are allowed to do that. You are allowed to pray that a person should die. I would have said without this, the knowledge of this, no, you're not. That's crazy. Life is the most dear thing there is. The extension of life, you never know what it means. And who knows if that person is supposed to live longer because he's supposed to atone for sins he committed. And that suffering is helping him atone. Who knows the message in that suffering? Who knows? So yes, you cannot take a knife and kill the person. You can't pull the plug on the person. But can you pray for the person to die? Yes, you can. Says of Moshe Feinstein, of all things, you can pray for a person to die if they are suffering greatly. You can pray for that person's death. And again, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, his maid, who was not seen as a negative by the Gemara did not say, how could she throw that vessel and stop them from praying and cause his death? How could she do that? No, the Gemara has no criticism at all about her. You see from this, you're allowed to do it. The one view I saw, Rabbi Bleich, a contemporary writer, says the one thing he saw some halachic authorities say, the only exception is, number one, if you are in the person's presence, you can't do this. In other words, if you are right there next to the machines, and you say, you know, they're suffering greatly, I want them to die, you may actually take the machine, you know, and do something. Because you're so overwhelmed, so therefore you can't do this in the presence of the person, because you may lead you to actual committing of a murder or suicide, right? And the other thing is that you can't do it, this one view he brings says, if you are not an objective observer, which means, he says, if maybe you're the relative, you think you're objective, you may be saying unconsciously, you know, I've been coming here every day for a year and we're paying so much money to keep my father on dialysis or whatever it is and so on and so on. And really, you know, I'd be better off if he died. Is that an objective view or is that your view because, you know, you've been doing this for so long, enough already? So this view says, for Black quotes as well, that maybe it wouldn't go for someone who is so close to the person. You might think the opposite, but you're so close you really can't see things clearly. So there may be some exceptions, but yet then what we learn from this from Moshe Feinstein says is that there is a time where it can be appropriate to pray for a person to die.
What if the person asks you to pull the plug and begs you to pull the plug?
I would say you still can't do it unless you still cannot do an active, you know, mode of euthanasia or suicide. You cannot do that. Cannot do that. No. Even if they beg you, you cannot do it. Now, I have these questions come up. I've mentioned before where people call me and say, Rabbi, I'm in a situation now where I'm working with someone and they want us to pull the plug. And the doctor has just given me an order to pull the plug today. Go pull the plug. So I say, you can't do it. You cannot do it. So what do I do? So can you drop out of the case? Drop out. I know it sounds, tell the doctor to have someone else do it. Well, it's not good to tell someone else to do it either, because they also can't do it. That person also can't do it, but you have no choice. You know, you can't control everyone else, but you can't do it. Or a doctor will tell me, I've had this, a doctor will say, Rabbi, I've been told by these people, I want them not to go, they don't want to go on with any more treatments and to stop them and so on. Now I'll say to them, well, what do you mean? Can the treatments still help the person live? And then if not, she says, yes, they could. Those treatments, we could overcome this infection if these treatments were continued. Then I'd have to say, well, then you have to continue them. Then you cannot stop. If the treatments really aren't doing anything anymore and it's been decided that these really are a long shot and it's, person's not being helped, then you're not required to go to heroic efforts necessarily. All right? But to actually pull the plug, that you cannot do. And again, I've told certain doctors, you'll have to tell people I cannot do that. here's some recommendations of other doctors if you'd like to discuss it with. I have to pull out of this case at this point, which I'm sure is very hard for a doctor to do because I've been with them for months and months, and they respect me, and I've worked with them, but that is the only choice one would have in that situation. Yes?
I don't want to get you off topic, but if God gives life and takes it away, it seems like that kind of life support is artificial anyway. So how do we make an allowance to be like on a breathing machine?
Right.
Where you can do it, but you can't undo it.
Right, because it's understood that we have to do whatever we can to keep life going. Because again, otherwise you could say, as we know, some did say and some say today, that, well, a Christian Scientist or others, no medicine either. No medication. Why medicine?
So you have to do...
Why surgery?
Right.
God wants them to die. So what are you intervening and trying to save his life for? God wants him to die. So here, as long as you can keep him alive, we're supposed to keep him alive. You could argue these other things are also artificial in the sense that they're human involvement in what should have been, you know, just God's decision without our getting involved. So that would be the reason. However, you could reach a point where if the person's not being healed anymore, the mitzvah of healing, the rabbis say, is to make the person better, to make him... to improve his quality of life. If you can't do that, then you're not required to start the treatments. Once they've been started, that's where the issue is, can I now pull the plug? But do you have to put him on the first place on the machine? You may not have to. If it's decided this is really not going to improve his life and heal him, you may not have to put him on. But you can't take him off once he's already at that level.
Couldn't you argue that the surgeon was placed there because God wanted him to say that
way? Yes. So, and in fact, the argument is, as opposed to those who say you shouldn't get involved because God wants this person to die, and they argue we're real believers, you're not, because we let God, you know, carry things out the way he wants to. It's just the opposite. We in fact say if God really wanted to kill that person, then your involvement is not going to stop it. If you really believe in God, then you should know that just because you're going to operate, just because you're going to do this to him, he's not going to save that person. If God wants to take him, he will take him anyway. You're told to do whatever you can, and then God will decide what he's going to do. Let me just conclude by saying that when it comes to analyzing where another person is at, we are never sure. We never know what is going on in another person's head. There's a story that I once read from an author who was about to commit suicide, like in New York on the river, was about to commit suicide, and someone saw this person and said, "Are you so-and-so?" Yeah, he said, "Oh, I just read your last book. It was such a great book, such a wonderful book." And the person then didn't commit suicide. You never know. A good word to someone. You never know what's going on in a person's head. You never know. Never know. So say those good words, do those good things. Yes.